And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. One day's February the 4th, 35th day of the year. 330 days remain until this year is over with. This day marks the approximate midpoint of winter in the Northern Hemisphere and of summer in the Southern Hemisphere. I remember when I was in South America, it would rain every afternoon at 2 o'clock, and by 4 you would dry. What a place. On this day in history, in the year 211, following the death of Rome's Emperor Septimius Severus at Eboracum, that's modern York in England, were preparing to lead a campaign against the Caledonians, the empires left in the control of his two sons, Caracalla and Geta. They spend all their time quarreling with each other. He had ordered them to make peace, but you know how that goes. In the year 960, the coronation of Zhao Qianyin as Emperor Taizu of Song, initiating the Song Dynasty period of China, that would last more than 300 years. 1169, a strong earthquake struck the Ionian coast of Sicily, caused tens of thousands of injuries and deaths, especially in Catania. 1454, in the 13 Years' War, the Secret Council of the Prussian Confederation sent a formal act of disobedience to the Grand Master. Told him where to get off. 1555, John Rogers is burned at the stake. He became the first English Protestant martyr under Mary I of England. 1703, in Edo, which is now called Tokyo, all but one of the 47 Ronin commit seppuku, ritual suicide, as recompense for avenging their master's death. They didn't mess around in ancient Japan. 1758, the city of Macapa in Brazil is founded by Sebastião Veiga Cabral. In 1789, George Washington is unanimously elected as the first president of the U.S. by the U.S. Electoral College. 1794. The French legislature abolishes slavery throughout all the territories of the French First Republic. It would be reestablished in the French West Indies in 1802. But at least that was a good start. 1797. The Riobamba earthquake strikes Ecuador. 40,000 casualties. 1801, John Marshall sworn in as Chief Justice of the United States. 1810, the Napoleonic Wars, Britain seized Guadalupe. 1820, the Chilean Navy, under the command of Lord Cochrane, completes the two-day-long capture of Valdivia with just 300 men and two ships. 1825, the Ohio Legislature authorizes the construction of the Ohio and Erie Canal, and the Miami and Erie Canal. 1846, the first Mormon pioneers make their exodus from Nauvoo, Illinois. They went westwards towards Salt Lake Valley. At that point in time, there was no Salt Lake City. 1859, the Codex Sinaiticus is discovered in Egypt. Now, the Codex Sinaiticus, for those who are not familiar with it, it was called the Sinai Bible. It's one of the four great Uncial Codices. In other words, an ancient handwritten copy of a Christian Bible written in Greek. It's considered a historical treasure. The Codex is an Alexandrian-type text-type manuscript written in Uncial letters on parchment and dated paleographically to the mid-4th century. There we go. Everything, sometimes it gets a mind of its own. 1861, American Civil War. In Montgomery, Alabama, delegates from six breakaway U.S. states meet and form the Confederate States of America. 1899, the Philippine-American War began with the Battle of Manila. 1932, the Second Sino-Japanese War. Harbin Manchuria falls to Japan. 1938, Adolf Hitler appoints himself head of the Armed Forces High Command. In other words, he pulled an Alexander Haig. I'm in charge. 1941, the USO was created to entertain American troops overseas. World War II. Santo Tomas internment camp is liberated from Japanese authority. 1945, World War II. The Yalta Conference between the Big Three, that's Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, opens at the Wadia Palace in the Crimea. Also in 45, the British Indian Army and the Imperial Japanese Army began a series of battles known as the Battle of Pogoku and Irrawaddy River operations. 1948, Ceylon, later called Sri Lanka, becomes independent within the British Commonwealth. 1961, the Angolan War of Independence and the Greater Portuguese Colonial War begin. 1966, all Nippon Airways Flight 60 plunges into Tokyo Bay. 133 people die. 1967, Lunar Orbiter Program. Lunar Orbiter 3 lifts off from Cape Canaveral's Launch Complex 13 on its mission to identify possible landing sites for the Surveyor and Apollo spacecraft. 1969, Yasser Arafat takes over as chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization. 1974, the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnaps Patty Hearst from her apartment in Berkeley, California. Also in 74, M-62 coach bombing. The Provisional Irish Republican Army explodes a bomb on a bus carrying off-duty British Armed Forces personnel in Yorkshire, England. 9 soldiers and 3 civilians are killed. 1975, Haiching earthquake. It was a magnitude 7.3 on the Richter scale. Occurs in Haiching, Liaoning, China. 1976, in Guatemala and Honduras, an earthquake kills more than 22,000. 1977, a Chicago Transit Authority elevated train rear-ends another and derails. 11 are killed, 180 are injured. It's the worst accident in the Chicago Transit Authority's history. 1992, a coup d'etat is led by Hugo Chavez against Venezuelan President Carlos Andres Perez. 1997, en route to Lebanon, two Israeli Sikorsky CH-53 troop transport helicopters collide mid-air over northern Galilee, killed 73. 1998, the 5.9 Afghanistan earthquake shakes the Takhar province with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 7, which is considered very strong. 2,323 are killed, 818 are injured. Damage is extreme. 1999, unarmed West African immigrant Amadou Diallo is shot 41 times before plainclothes New York police officers on an unrelated stakeout, which of course inflamed race relations in the city. They never really said why they shot him and why they shot him 41 times. In the year 2000, the World Summit Against Cancer for the New Millennium, a Charter of Paris is signed by the President of France, Jacques Chirac, and Director General of UNESCO, Kirochiro Matsura, initiating World Cancer Day, which is held on February 4th every year. 2003, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia adopts a new constitution. It becomes a loose confederacy between Montenegro and Serbia. 2004, Facebook, a mainstream online social networking site founded by Mark Zuckerberg and Eduardo Saverin, and it's since gone off the rails and thinks it's a country unto itself, apparently. 2015, TransAsia Airway flight 235 with 58 people on board en route from the Taiwanese capital Taipei to Kinmen crashes into the Keelung River just after takeoff. 43 people die. And in 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic causes all casinos in Macau to be closed down for 15 days. And that resulted in billions of dollars in losses to the owners. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Andrew Corsini, Gilbert of Sempringham, John DeBrito, Goldroff of Argnelli, Blessed Rabenus Morris, Rimbert, Veronica, Day of the Armed Struggle in Angola. Don't you like these high-sounding names? Earliest day on which Ash Wednesday can fall, March 10th is the latest, celebrated on the first day of Lent in Christianity. In Sri Lanka, it's Independence Day. In California, Missouri, in the U.S., it's Rosa Parks Day. She's the woman that refused to give up her seat on the bus. World Cancer Day. Alrighty, let's see what else we got. $11.94, 100,000 in ransom is paid for Richard I, King of England. He was on the way back. That's Richard the Lionhearted. He was on the way back from the Crusades, and he was captured and locked up by the king of another country until the ransom was paid. That's where Robin Hood comes in, and the fact that Prince John wasn't going to pay the ransom.
Motion detected at the front door.
Okay, 1508, Maximilian I assumes the imperial title without being crowned. Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, becomes Governor General of the States General of the United Provinces in the Netherlands. In 1620, Prince Bethlen Gabor of Hungary signs a peace treaty with the Holy Roman Emperor, Ferdinand II. In 1657, Oliver Cromwell, Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England, Scotland, and Ireland, grants residency to Luis Carvajal. In 1670, in the Battle of Singhagad, Shivaji Commander Tanaji's Malasuri recaptures the fort of Singhad from the Mongols. He scaled the walls with the help of a pet monitor lizard. Don't know how he did it, but he did it. 1699, 350 rebellious Strautsky were executed in Moscow. 1783, the worst quake in 8 years kills over 50,000 in Calabria in Italy. 1784, the first unmanned balloon flight in Ireland. 1787, the first Anglican bishops of New York and Pennsylvania are consecrated in London. And on this day in 1787, Shays' Rebellion, which was a uprising of Massachusetts farmers who were drowning in debt, officially failed. In 1797, the earthquake in Quito, Ecuador, kills 41,000. In 1822, free American blacks settle Liberia and West Africa. In 1824, J.W. Goodrich introduces rubber galoshes to the public. Before that, they got their feet wet. 1847, the first U.S. telegraph company is established in Maryland. 1849, on this date, University of Wisconsin begins in one room. They had 20 students. 1854, Alvin Bove proposes the name Republican Party in Ripon, Wisconsin. 1864, the skirmish at Big Black River Bridge took place in Mississippi. 1865, the Hawaiian Board of Education is formed. On this date in 1865, a little late, Robert E. Lee is named General-in-Chief of Confederate Forces. 1866, the founder of the Christian Science Movement, Mary Baker Eddy, reportedly cured her injuries by simply opening a Bible. In 1880, the Black Donnelly Massacre in Biddulph, Ontario, Irish immigrants, James, who was 63, Johanna, who was 56, John, who was 32, Thomas, who was 25, and Bridget, who was 21, they were all Donnellys, murdered at home by members of the Vigilance Committee. They were considered squatters. The 1887 Interstate Commerce Act authorizes federal regulation of the railroads. 1901, Emperor of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Franz Joseph I, gives a speech condemning the demands of national groups and calls for economic and social reform. 1908, star number 46 was added to the U.S. flag for Oklahoma with the addition of the Union of Oklahoma to the Union of Oklahoma on November 16, 1907. 1913, Lewis Pearlman patented the demountable auto tire carrying wheel rim. 1914, the U.S. Congress approved the Burnett anti-immigration law. 1915, experiments to find the cause of pellagra began at Mississippi State Penitentiary. 1919, the city of Bremen, Soviet Republic, is overthrown. 1922, after boycotts and international pressure, Japan agrees to return the Shantung province to China. 1924 was the first Winter Olympics. Norway swept the medals in the Nordic combined event at the inaugural Chamonix Winter Olympics. 1930, the first tieless, soundless, and shockless streetcar tracks are installed in New Orleans. 1933, German President Paul von Hindenburg limits freedom of the press. He'd been a general in World War I and became president and was eventually forced into retirement by Adolf. 1944, the U.S. 7th Infantry Division captures Kwajalein in the Pacific. 1949, on this date, there was a failed assassination attempt on the Shah of Persia, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. 1957, the first electric portable typewriter was placed on sale in Syracuse, New York. 1961, Sputnik 7 launched into Earth orbit. It was a probable Venus probe failure. 1962, Russian newspaper Izvestia reports that baseball is actually an old Russian game. 1968, around 100 Indians and Pakistanis from Kenya arrive in Britain, running from discrimination. 1969, John Madden was named head coach of the NFL's Oakland Raiders. 1971, Rolls-Royce declared itself to be bankrupt. 1971, the National Guard was mobilized to quell rioting in Wilmington, North Carolina. And in 1972, Strom Thurmond suggested John Lennon be deported. And other people suggested Strom Thurmond be deported. Who, you know, go figure. All right, we have come to the end of our little history session for today. We're going to talk more about ghosts, this time in the United States. We were talking about, little Eva. We're talking about the poorhouse that later became Ashmore Estates, which was a private sanatorium. In 1906, circumstances forced Joe Bloxam to become a resident of the poorhouse. And despite how gloomy one might imagine living in a poorhouse can be, Joe, who was 61 at the time, reported he made a home for himself and found contentment there. He resided at the poorhouse for 15 years, working with the superintendent to maintain the laws on the grounds, keeping them clean and presentable. When he was 76, he took a trip to Charleston and was seen near the railroad tracks. Shortly after that, a motorist stopped to pick him up as he stumbled toward home. He had severe bruising around his shoulders and upper body, and the Good Samaritan drove him the rest of the way home. Once he got there, according to the urban legend, he was taken down to the boiler room to await the doctor. Now, since Joe would have had a bed on the premises, they apparently hoped the warmth of the boiler room would aid him in recovery. And nobody knows for certain, but it's supposed that Joe, who was described as quite feeble, had tried to beat a train and failed. Didn't strike him head-on, but apparently it had sideswiped him, which left him battered and bruised. And unfortunately, the shock and trauma from being hit overwhelmed poor Joe, and he died in the boiler room. According to an obituary printed in the Oakland Messenger,
and motion detected at the front door,
reproduced on the poorhouse story website, Joe was buried 2 days later in the little green plot on the property. But it's said that Joe continues to haunt the place he last called home, which became Ashmore Estates. He appears as a shadowy apparition in the eerie corridors, and his gruff voice has been captured as an EVP by paranormal investigators. Leslie Michael, the case manager and assistant lead investigator for the Illinois Metaphysical and Paranormal Society, states that Joe still inhabits the boiler room where he died. According to Leslie, even if you're not seeing anything or hearing any EVPs, you feel like you're not alone. It goes beyond just feeling unseen eyes watching you, though. The boiler room is rampant with paranormal activity. People have reported being touched or scratched, and electronic equipment act up, and things are occasionally thrown at visitors' heads. Among the things that are thrown are light bulbs. In fact, when television host Mark Rivera and his cameraman visited Ashmore Estates to film a Halloween special, Mark was talking with Leslie in the boiler room when his cameraman wandered into the next room. And on the footage from Steve's camera, you can see the shot pan past the table cluttered with dirty wires and cables and a light bulb. And as the cameraman continues into the room, there's a clank and a curse can be heard. According to Steve, somehow the light bulb flew from where it was sitting on the table and hit him in the head. Now, Leslie and Becky seem to think that Joe's to blame, suggesting that he's usually angry and doesn't much like being messed with. Excuse me. And the freakiest of all? According to Leslie, sometimes you can hear growls coming from the shadows. So you have to ask yourself, do they come from Joe or from something darker? There's really no way to know for sure. Well, let's go to Peoria. That used to be one of the catchphrases back in vaudeville. Will it play in Peoria? We got the Peoria State Hospital. If
motion detected at the front door.
If you work from the assumption that hospitals are so frequently haunted because of the copious amounts of... Well, now that all the sounds have stopped, we'll go back to talking about the Peoria State Hospital. And as I was saying, if you work from the assumption hospitals are frequently haunted because of the copious amount of emotional energy, both negative and positive, that is generated there and the trauma contained within the walls, Peoria State Hospital is the perfect petri dish for paranormal activity. If you look over the list of treatments that were implemented at Peoria State Hospital, it's like leading a timeline of psychiatric medical treatment. 1902, color therapy was introduced. 1903, light therapy. 1905, hydrotherapy. 1906, tent colonies were started. 1908, industrial therapy was introduced. 1909, phototherapy. In 1930, the syphilis outbreak was treated by infecting patients with malaria. Now, what malaria would have to do with syphilis is anybody's guess. But I'm sure some enterprising doctor got a reward of some sort for coming up with this brilliant idea. 1938, insulin shock therapy is introduced. 1940, lobotomies and trepanning are performed on patients. 1942, electroconvulsive therapy is introduced. 1951, occupational therapy. 63, you have group therapy. Now, some of these procedures, such as color and light therapy, are innocuous enough, but when you get to things like lobotomies and tree planting and electroconvulsive therapy, that'd be traumatic and terrifying ordeals for anybody involved, both the patients and the witnesses. But there's still more. In addition to the deaths you might expect to be associated with a hospital like this, Peoria State Hospital is also connected with at least a handful of murders. According to a page from the Peoria Asylum's History About the Abandoned Whereabouts website, 1903, a patient was allegedly beaten to death by two attendants, but the two perpetrators were never charged. In 1967, a patient smashed a nurse in the head with a steel bar and killed her. 1972, two patients were murdered by fellow patients. One patient was struck in the head with a chain while waiting in line for lunch. Another patient was beaten to death. No efforts were made over the years to make the hospital as comfortable a little place to live as possible. It was still, the site of several outbreaks could be attributed to poor care or supervision. For example, in 1909, a pellagra outbreak began. And this outbreak lasted at least 3 years, affecting more than 500 patients and killed 150 of them, caused by poor diet, usually. Pellagra is a disease that causes diarrhea, eczema, intensely itchy inflammation of the skin, and dementia. What's more, in some cases, disease also causes aggression, confusion, and emotional disturbance. Now, given that in 1909, the Peoria State Hospital was called the Illinois General Hospital for the Insane, one can only imagine how much the pellagra outbreak would exacerbate pre-existing conditions in the patients. Another outbreak occurred in the 30s. This time it was syphilis. And syphilis also causes skin rashes and sores, and if left untreated, it can also progress to the point it can cause dementia or death. Now, penicillin used to treat syphilis now had been discovered in 1928, but it wasn't a popular treatment for infections till 1942. Until then, many different experimental treatments were used on those infected, some of which might now be considered as dangerous as the disease itself. One such treatment, the one used at Peoria State Hospital, was to infect the patient with malaria, which I mentioned before. Now, malaria causes a high fever, and the hope was the fever would offset the syphilis, effectively treating one disease for another. The note on the Peoria Asylum's website about this treatment simply said there were untold numbers of deaths. Hospital closed in 1973, and since then the facility's reputation has grown. Stories abound about suicides in the woods and ghostly children who play with balls, and there are a lot of EVPs that have been recorded. One of the most interesting stories, however, actually took place back in 1910 when the hospital was still operating. According to this story, a man working in a printing house suffered some form of mental break that left him incapable of intelligent speech, to the point he couldn't even tell somebody his name. Sometime before 1910, he was taken into custody by a police officer who noted in his report the man was a bookbinder. When the gentleman was checked into the Peoria State Hospital, known at the time as the Illinois Asylum for the Incurable Insane, he was signed in as a bookbinder. Now, in some stories, his name is said to have been Manuel Bookbinder, or M. Bookbinder. Regardless of all the reports, one thing that folks agree on is he quickly came to be known as Old Book. Though he couldn't speak, he was otherwise strong and healthy. So when the man in charge of the hospital, George Zeller, conscripted patients for a burial corp, Old Book was among them. Now, the burial corpse, as it was called, was a group of six patients and one staff member who, as their name suggests, was responsible for digging the graves for those who died at the hospital and whose remains weren't claimed by friends or family. Now, the hospital had been built according to what was known as the cottage plan, which meant it was quite spread out and comprised several different buildings. Thus, most of the patients didn't know one another. In fact, there was a fair chance even the staff didn't know every patient, so funerals are usually relatively unemotional. The burial corpse would dig the grave and stand quietly off to the side while the funeral service was conducted. And once the funeral was over, the corpse would return to the graveside to fill in the hole. Surprised everybody when at his very first burial, Old Book took off his cap, wiped his eyes, and leaned against the huge old elm tree at the center of the graveyard. And he just sobbed like you wouldn't believe. He did this at every funeral. He'd dig the grave, and then once the service began, he'd take off his cap, wipe his eyes, sob against the tree everybody called the graveyard elm. When the time came for Old Book's own funeral, held in a hospital cemetery, this service was remarkably well attended because Book had become sort of a local legend about the facility. In fact, Dr. Zeller himself officiated, and according to his memoir, several hundred people, including staff and patients, attended. Book's casket was suspended over the grave by two crossbeams, where it remained till members of the burial group corpse loaded into the ground at the end of the service. In Dr. Zeller's book, which was called Befriending the Bereft, he wrote, "Just as the choir finished the last lines of Rock of Ages, the men grasped the rope, stooped forward, and with a powerful muscular effort prepared to lift the coffin. They did that to permit the removal of the crossbeams and allow it to gently descend into the grave. At a given signal, they heaved away on the ropes. The next instant, all four lay on their backs. See, this coffin, instead of offering resistance as it normally would, went into the air like an eggshell, as if it was empty. Now, the scene that followed was said to be a bit chaotic, as one could well imagine. But the spookiest part was a loud wailing voice suddenly pierced all the commotion and confusion, and it drew every eye in the place to the location where it began, the graveyard elm. And there, visible to everybody attending his funeral, was Old Book. He was crying and wailing in the words of Dr. Zeller with an earnestness that outrivaled anything he'd ever shown before. Well, this time it was his own funeral, so he had a vested interest. Well, after a moment of stunned silence, the lid of Book's coffin was lifted off, because surely if he was leaning against the graveyard elm, he couldn't be dead in the coffin. Well, the instant the lid came off, the wailing stopped. And there inside the coffin was Old Book himself, dead as a hammer. But when his mourners looked once again at the tree he'd been sobbing against, they found his apparition had vanished.
According to Dr. Zeller, it was an awful situation, but it was a real one. He said, "I saw him. 100 nurses saw him. 300 spectators saw him. He was standing against the tree at the same time he's lying in his coffin." In his book, Lost in Darkness, Benjamin Jeffries reports that soon after Old Book's funeral, the graveyard nail began to wither and die. And it resisted all efforts made to save it, and a year later it was as dead as Old Book. Well, when workmen came to remove the dead tree from the graveyard, they struck it with an axe, and they heard an unearthly scream come out of it. For years and years, every attempt to remove the tree was foiled by the sound of the horrible wailing that emanated from it each time it was touched with fire or steel. Eventually, nature, unpitying nature, saw to its removal when the graveyard elm was struck during a lightning storm. Not for that, the tree might still be standing there today, a not-so-silent monument to one of Peoria State Hospital's most infamous and beloved patients. So the question comes up, How could old Buck be standing there by the tree at the same time he's lying in his coffin? No one has ever been able to answer that question. Well, let's go down to Indiana. Indianapolis, to be exact. Central State Hospital. When psychic Benjamin Jeffries first arrived at Central State Hospital in Indianapolis, his initial impression was of a thick, heavy blanket made up of extreme sadness and pain. And given the history of the place, it's not surprising he would have that attitude. Formerly known as the Central Indiana Hospital for the Insane, this psychiatric hospital was opened in 1848. In those days, it was one building that had five patients. But it was situated on over 100 acres of land, and the need for its services was so great that it continued to expand. 1926, the name was changed to Central State Hospital. And by 1928, it housed around 3,000 patients in several buildings. And beneath the ground, connecting the buildings, was a veritable rabbit warren of tunnels. Allegations of rampant patient abuse surrounded the hospital from its earliest days right up until it closed in 1994. One of the most persistent rumors alleges that the tunnels deep in the bowels of the facilities are more than just a way to get from one building to another. It said that those tunnels contain dark, dungeon-like rooms with chains and shackles in them, and that the more problematic patients, those who screamed uncontrollably or had violent tendencies, were frequently kept down there, alone, in the dark, for unknown lengths of time. Unfortunately, there's plenty of evidence to back up these rumors. Not only do hospital workmen and former employees tell stories about stumbling into these rooms today, back in 1870, the superintendent of the hospital wrote about them. In a letter to the governor of Indiana, he wrote, "Basement dungeons are dark, humid, and foul, unfit for life of any kind, filled with maniacs who raved and howled like tortured beasts, for want of light and food and ordinary human association habiliments. We think everyone left in those conditions would rave and howl, and the suffering of a person chained that way would be multiplied if they're already suffering from afflictions of the mind." Interestingly, this treatment of patients was justified under the guise of a retraining exercise. The isolation and darkness were meant to be therapeutic to reverse the patient's insanity. Even understanding that we know a lot more about treating mental illness now than we did then, it's difficult, if not impossible, to comprehend how such treatment could be justified or even considered beneficial. Thankfully, once news of these treatments was made public in 1894, the public outcry was such that use of restraints at the hospital was greatly limited. Still, even those patients who weren't chained up in underground dungeons were kept in conditions that might, if one was feeling generous, be called substandard. Patients slept on straw mattresses in buildings with rotten floors and reeking roofs. And with the leaking roofs, you can imagine the quality of the straw under those damp conditions. Dr. Everts, the superintendent, reported that the wards these patients were housed in were without adequate provisions for light, heat, and ventilation. Patients were lucky enough to have a bed could find themselves confined to it for days at a time. In fact, the very building was used against the patients. Window wells were used as tiny cages that would allow patients to be out in the sunlight when unable to walk about or escape. Frustrated in his attempt to improve the conditions in the hospital, Dr. Everts eventually resigned in protest in 1872. Unfortunately, his protest appears to have accomplished nothing. Allegations of abuse persisted till the hospital closed. Staff members were accused of everything from rape and sexual battery to neglect and physical abuse. And though there were plenty of allegations, there didn't seem to be any convictions of any staff members at the hospital. Still, the accusations were taken seriously enough that Governor Evan Bayh ordered a full investigation into how things are done at the hospital. Well, 5 miles of tunnels run like a labyrinth beneath and between the various buildings of this facility. They're dark and claustrophobic and have a history of unimaginable terror and torment. No wonder they're the setting for a variety of urban legends and unsettling stories. According to Crime TV's documentary about Central State Hospital, one ghostly presence said to haunt the tunnels is the Red Lady. Now, she's said to be a nurse who used to work at the Central State Hospital. She frequently wore a red cape and did a lot of ground checks during her shifts to ensure nobody was wondering about where they didn't belong. And according to the story, I work in the old main building. The nurse was involved in a tragic, though unspecified, accident and died as a result. Maybe she doesn't realize that death released her from responsibilities at the hospital because people reported seeing the flash of her red cape when they're down in those dark tunnels. Further, it said that if you're wandering around down there and she doesn't think you belong, she'll touch you to let you know you're in the wrong place and stop you from going on. Maybe somebody ought to find the red lady and tell her shift is over. She can rest now. Well, there was a book called Haunted Indiana by Mark Merriman. And one section says when it was entitled When Darkness Comes to Central State. And it tells stories about eerie and unnerving events at that facility. One whispered story it recounts about the tunnels is about a nurse while exploring the tunnels discovered a room with a dirt floor and manacles attached to the walls. She was disturbed by the sight and its implications, so she immediately left. And about a year later, she happened to be walking by that room again when she heard the unmistakable sound of moaning come from inside. Despite her terror at the sound, she opened the door to look inside and found the room dark and barren. Shaken by the encounter, she fled the tunnels, and it was many months later before she even told the events to her supervisor. The supervisor told her, "Never mind that. We all know about that room, and we stay well away from it. A lot of us have heard those things, but none of us know what to do about it." They all knew about the room and stayed away from it. How many people have to witness moans coming from an empty room before it becomes a commonplace you don't even think it's unusual enough to mention to new employees? And, of course, the most widely reported story from Central State Hospital is the story of Alvin. And it also has a deep connection to the tunnels. Now, Alvin was a low-risk patient at the hospital and, as such, was allowed to wander freely about the grounds. One day, though, he just vanished. Nobody had any idea where he went. Though a thorough search was conducted, nobody could find any sign of him anywhere. Now, since Alvin didn't pose a risk to himself or anybody else, eventually the staff stopped looking, assuming he'd wandered off the grounds. When he got ready, he'd wander back. Well, sometimes later, the reports differ as to whether it was months or years, a woman named Agnes was admitted to the hospital. And after she's been there a while, she had developed a habit of wandering off. And according to one former nurse, she'd just disappear from the ward and they'd have to search for her. Inevitably, she'd be found on the steps that lead down into the catacombs, just sitting by herself. Got to be so regular that when she disappeared, instead of calling security, they'd just send one of the nurses down to bring her back up. Well, finally, one of the nurses, probably having become tired of being sent repeatedly to collect Agnes from the stairs, asked her why she kept going down there. And Agnes shrugged and said she'd like to go visit her friend Alvin, who lived in the tunnels. Now, had Agnes given any other name for her friend, the nurse might have dismissed her response as fanciful thinking of the result of a troubled mind, but Alvin wasn't really a common name and reminded the nurse of the missing patient from a couple of years before. Maybe Alvin hadn't left the grounds at all. Maybe he was still there, living in the maze-like tunnels beneath their feet. If that was the case, she felt he needed to be found and retrieved for his own safety as well as everybody else's. It just wouldn't do to have a mental patient, however harmless he might be, wandering around in the tunnels beneath the hospital. Nurse reported what Agnes said to her superiors, and another search was conducted looking for Alvin. And it was as fruitless as the first one until after several hours, one of the searchers found a partially open crawl space off the tunnels. He looked inside, and there lay Alvin's body, and clearly he'd been dead for quite some time. Now, the discovery of Alvin's body brought up a lot of questions. How did it get into that claustrophobic crawl space? How did he die? When did he die? But even more disquieting is after the discovery of Alvin's corpse, Agnes stopped sneaking off to hang out in the catacombs, and she never spoke about Alvin again. It was though Alvin's spirit had been lingering and waiting for his remains to be discovered and put to rest so he could find peace. Certainly that's possible. One former psychiatric nurse who worked at Central State Hospital for years claimed to being agnostic when it came to the supernatural. And she told Mark Merriman that the administration discouraged staff from sharing ghost stories, but in spite of that, they did it on occasion. In fact, it seemed like everybody who worked there had at least one story to talk about. this particular nurse, who went by the pseudonym of Ms. Torres, and had an interesting story to tell. Shortly before the hospital shut its doors for good, Ms. Torreson was working the late shift. And because they'd been moving patients to other hospitals in preparation for Central State closing, there was a lot of commotion on the ward. And some psychiatric patients didn't deal well with change, so more often than usual, additional effort was required to get them settled into the bed. About 3 o'clock in the morning, though, things quieted down enough she could take a break and relax. Unfortunately, that break was cut short when she heard the sound of a woman sobbing. When the nurse got up to investigate, she realized that sound was coming from a room at the end of the hallway that should have been empty. It belonged to a patient that had already transferred to another facility. Well, she was aggravated at the thought somebody had wandered out of her room and into this empty one, but when she paused outside that room, listening to the sound of sobs coming from inside, her mood changed. She said there was something about it that made all the hair on her arm stand up. It was heartbreaking, like somebody inside was in incredible pain or distress. But when she opened the door, the crying suddenly stopped and...
Motion detected at the front door.
She saw there was nobody there. The room was empty. Even the beds were gone. She stood there in the darkness of the hallway, and in that moment, she said she was scared to death. Well, she scurried away from that room and back to her desk, where she poured a cup of coffee and tried to convince herself that there was a logical explanation. Maybe it was just the wind, or maybe her imagination. Well, when she happened to look down the hallway toward where she'd heard the weeping, she saw this hazy kind of shadow floating in front of the room. She said, I turned my head and stared in that direction, and at that moment it zipped down the hall and disappeared into the wall at the end of the hallway. Well, she wasn't the only person to have seen something like that either. A few years later, when the hospital was empty, it was likely patrolled by police officers. One officer was alone on the second floor when suddenly he heard a woman's high-pitched cry. Spinning around to locate the source, he saw a hazy feminine form dart through his flashlight beam. In no time at all, she ran to the end of the hallway and vanished into the wall. Now, this might be the same darting shadow that Dan Hall caught on video when he's investigating Central State Hospital. In that footage, captured by a stationary infrared camera, a hazy shape darts in front of the camera. It's not quite human, but not quite inhuman as well. It moves fluidly like water, though it looks more like smoke. At the other end of the hall is a door with a light reflecting from its glass windows. Nothing unusual is reflected in that glass. The line of sight between it and the camera is never broken in the video, and you can always see the light reflecting. But the camera's autofocus feature was triggered, and that only happens when something crosses its line of sight. So something did move in front of the camera. You have to ask yourself, did he capture one of the spirits at one of the halls of this behemoth of a hospital? Well, hours and hours of footage from paranormal investigators have been investigated. And for 3 seconds in that one particular piece of footage, you see the figure moving. And strange occurrences aren't limited to just one building on the Central State campus. Former employees and patients reported hearing unexplainable sounds, disembodied footsteps, slamming doors, and sobbing in several locations in and around the hospital, including the administrative building and the power station. One former patient, who was referred to as Patient X in a documentary done by Dan Hall, recalled one of the nurses who used to work at the hospital. According to this patient, she had a very distinctive witch-like laugh, and when they were doing the filming for the documentary, they captured an EVP that sounded very much like that woman's laugh. You might even call it a cackle, like a witch. Now, there's no indication the nurse the patient spoke of has passed away, but you might consider this laugh to be evidence that energy from its time of operation still lingers at the hospital. A groundskeeper had a story that took place in the administrative building. He said, before I started working here, I never believed in ghosts. But after a few graveyard shifts, his feelings in that regard seemed to have shifted. Says he heard doors slam and nobody was around, and he heard unexplainable footsteps. One dramatic instance of footsteps happened one night when he was relaxing by himself in a side room in the administrative building.
That particular room had a huge glass window that overlooked the larger room it was in, possibly used by staff to keep an eye on the patients. Out of nowhere, he heard a distinctive sound of high heels click-clacking across the floor, heading straight toward him. Jumped out of his chair and looked through the window. Nobody was there, but those footsteps continued to approach right up to the other side of the glass he was looking through. When they got to the glass, the sounds paused for a moment, and he heard the footsteps turn and go back the way they'd come. And the whole time while he watched where those sounds were coming from, there was no one to be seen. Well, when psychic author Benjamin Jeffries visited Central State Hospital in 1994, he found himself powerfully drawn to the Bear Building.
Motion detected at the front door.
And that's reportedly where the criminally insane were housed. But even stronger was his attraction to the Carpentry Building, situated right beside the power station, which is alleged to be the hub of spiritual activity. The Carpentry Building captured his attention right away. While he was walking around it, taking photographs, he heard two men talking. One of them was crystal clear in his question, "What are you doing here?" Thinking he might be one of the hospital guards or policemen. Central State is in the middle of the city. He turned around to answer, but there was no one there. He was alone. But that voice had come from so close to him. Had it come from a mundane or human source, he would have seen the speaker. Now, he's investigated haunted locations all over the world and is used to brushes with the other side, but he still gets chill when he thinks about that voice. And then we have the power station. It's one of the areas of greatest paranormal activity at Central State. Some people believe the power station can act as a sort of battery for ghosts, amplifying and empowering them. And there's more on that in the New York locations we'll be talking about. One of those locations that you'll find quite interesting is called Rolling Hills Asylum. The people who subscribe to this theory also tend to believe that most ghosts and hauntings are the result of residual energy left behind when people die. That would explain why entities like that can affect electrical equipment, electromotive force, readers, and things like that. It also explains why phenomena reported near facilities that generate electricity tend to be stronger and more powerful than those reported elsewhere. Such is the case with the power station building at Central State Hospital. Paranormal activity in the power station tends to take the form of rattling pipes, unexplained voices, shadows, screams, and spontaneous equipment activity. In addition to these things, though, on at least one occasion, a workman at the power station was physically attacked by something he couldn't see. Midway through his shift, he became tired, so he found himself a comfortable place to take a nap deep into the bowels of the power station's basement. Chose a room with only one door so that nobody could sneak up on him and find him slacking off, or at least that's what he thought. He was jolted awake by the sensation of being choked. Breaking free from the stranglehold, he jumped to his feet and turned on the light to see whoever the cowardly wretch was that had attacked him in his sleep. But to his surprise, he was alone. And there was no way anybody could have left the room without him seeing it because he stood between the doorway and the rest of the room. But there was simply no one there. He retreated up to the light of day and told his colleague about the attack and pulled his shirt down and revealed dark red marks around his neck. The man refused to ever go back to that part of the power plant again, even when he was threatened with losing his job. And while Dan Hall and his crew were filming in the power station, they also captured several EVPs. First, it was recorded shortly after one of the psychics on the team mentioned feeling a force in the basement that wanted them to leave. On the video, none of the investigators or the film crew react to the voice at the time, so it's safe to assume they didn't hear it until they reviewed the footage later. But shortly after the psychic says the entity wanted to leave the room, the words "go for God's sake" can be heard in a whisper on the video. Once the team had exited the power station, recording equipment they left behind captured the sounds of pipe clanging. Now, there's no real logical reason for the pipes to make noise since the power station's been closed down for a number of years. Sounds like it's followed by an EVP of someone or something whispering, "Bye." Now, this does make a certain kind of sense, the kind that makes you never want to set foot in that building. When I was doing my radio show at a local station, my show was late in the evening, and my wife and I did a joint interview with
a guest, and as we were leaving the building, we were the last ones to leave, we heard a voice behind us say, "Bye." We turned around, there was nobody there, and I searched the entire first floor. There wasn't a soul to be found anywhere. But at least it was a polite voice. Now and then, patients die at a hospital, as you would expect. After all, a hospital is a place for sick people. But they might not be expected to die outside the building. So, in the write-up, When Darkness Comes to Central State, there was a Mr. Jarecki, a former employee who was interviewed. And he said at least one patient met his end in one of the beautiful ornate fountains out on the lawn. Not quite creepy enough to raise their hair on your arms, but another patient suffered a horrible death in the area of the grounds known as the Grove. There, beneath the sprawling boughs of trees, one patient brutally murdered another, beating to death with a rock. Perpetrator is promptly shipped off to another facility, but there are some who believe the victim is still there, or at least some part of him is. When you walk by that grove of trees at night, you can hear the screaming and moaning coming from it. Employees from the hospital also report seeing blurs of movement when they believe to be the spirits of patients running for the gate. When the hospital was operational, occasionally patients would make a run for it. They try to get out the gate to the hospital before the guards could catch them. So you have to wonder, are there spirits still there, trapped on the grounds and perpetually trying to escape what they view as captivity? Visitors to the hospital frequently report an oppressive air and a feeling that they're being watched. And according to Dan Hall, this place, its energy, began to work on all of us, stripping away the curiosity that brought us here and replacing it with fear and distortion. You never know what you're going to find in a place like that. Then let's turn to Louisville, Kentucky. Waverly Hills Sanatorium. There's shadow people, spectral nurses, ghostly children, distorted human forms crawling along the ceilings. Those are just some of the disturbing things people have encountered at Waverly Hills Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky. Originally a two-story building, the sanatorium eventually grew to be a massive structure. In fact, in its heyday, it was like a small city, self-sustaining and possessing its own zip code. It operated as a sanatorium or tuberculosis hospital, housing and treating over 400 patients at a time for many, many years. It closed its doors in 1961 after the development of streptomycin, an antibiotic proven to be effective in treating tuberculosis. That rendered the facility obsolete. Its reason for being was gone. It reopened the next year as Woodhaven Geriatrics Hospital, but was closed by the state in 1981 due to allegations of patient neglect and abuse. So with a history like that, is any wonder that Waverly Hills has been called one of the most haunted places on Earth? One thing it's known for is the sheer number of shadow people said to reside within its walls. Shadow people are exactly what the term implies, people-shaped shadows. Except that these shadows don't have a source. There's no one standing in a light to cast them. They're just there. Shadow people have take on several different shapes, everything from crude representations of humans to wispy or smoky mist. There are exceptions. Usually shadow people are formed of darkness so dense that light can't penetrate them. Theories about what causes shadow people are wildly diverse, running the gamut from overactive imagination to ghosts, demons, aliens, or even time travelers. Whatever they are, and whatever they want, many who've witnessed a shadow person have been irrevocably changed by the experience. Well, on that note, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We've run out of time once again. We'll be back tomorrow night, but once again, you'll hear stories from Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.